Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thank you for joining me today on RBN, whose website is republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit my website, spingola.com, and spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com, a site that one of our very wonderful dedicated listeners set up and maintains. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. My Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. My guest the first hour is Lynn Farrow. She is the author of the wonderful, wonderful book, The Iodine Crisis, What You Don't Know About Iodine Can Wreck Your Life. Her websites are lynnfarrow.net, and that's LynnFarrow.net, and breastcancerchoices.org. She is the editor at iodineresearch.com, and she is a journalist, a researcher, and a former college professor and speaker. Her own experience with breast cancer led to the discovery that someone had stolen a medicine with proven benefits reaching back 15,000 years. A medicine that not only helped her, but has helped millions. She currently serves as the director of Breast Cancer Choices, Inc., a nonprofit organization dedicated to scrutinizing the evidence for breast cancer procedures and treatments. Welcome to the program, Lynn.
Thank you, Deanna. It's just lovely to be talking with you.
Oh, well, I just so appreciate your book as I was going through it. And I've been taking Iodorol for probably over 5 years. And as I was going through your book, it suddenly dawned on me that I didn't have this problem that I used to have. And I thought, oh, that's right. You know? And I just, it's just amazing what I discovered by reading your book. And I had read Dr. David Brownstein's book, maybe 5 years ago, and that's probably why I started taking Iodorol to begin with. But anyway, I'm so delighted to have you on the program and to have your book.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I noticed, too, that my allergies had gone away. I'd started taking Iodorol for one reason, and a lot of other things cleared up, but it took somebody else mentioning that their allergies, seasonal allergies, had cleared up for me to realize, oh, wait a minute, how many years has it been since I wasn't sneezing in the spring?
Isn't that amazing?
So we have a parallel experience there.
Yes, and when I discovered it, I thought, oh my gosh, I don't hurt. It doesn't hurt anymore. And I was just so thrilled. It was something I'd had for years and years, and all of a sudden it wasn't there, and I hadn't really noticed. I don't know. Anyway, you talked to Dr. Tenpenny at a conference, and this was back in 2005, I believe, is what your book said.
Yes.
And she had, it was after you had been diagnosed, correct?
Yes.
And she said, well, have you thought about the iodine connection? And that was very, she was very instrumental in setting you on that path, correct?
Yes, and one of the things was that I almost got on the path to show that it couldn't possibly be true, because it seemed like an extreme remedy. In other words, it seemed to promise way more than it could possibly deliver. And so it was almost to prove her wrong or to look into it myself that I got on this journey, on this road. And it turned out that not only was she right, but she was right in spades, just way more than we could have ever foreseen. The history of iodine goes back so many years, and there's so many different conditions that iodine helps that I'm sure Dr. Tenpenny didn't realize that at the time, that she, this casual conversation that she had with me about the breast would turn out, would sort of explode, and I would spend years finding everything I could possibly find out about how iodine has benefited people for millennia.
And isn't that amazing? It took you having a serious life-threatening problem that has led to you helping so many other people, and having these websites and writing a book, and it's just opened up, well, a movement. You've started an iodine movement.
Yes, it really has become a group effort, that this thing, not even one person, but so many people jumped on. And I tried to, when I first brought the iodine information to my breast cancer think tank group, they said, "You're crazy, you know, please, Lynn, you know, let's try to be reasonable. There couldn't be anything like that." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to do some more research." And so I did, and I went back so far, and that I was even talking to archaeologists on the phone that were finding, in some earlier incarnations, iodine therapy was used with specific high iodine kelps. So there are ethnobotanists in archaeology sites that just study this kind of thing. So I found that, you know, even in the Egyptian scrolls, they had used seaweed, highly concentrated iodine kinds of seaweed, for breast cancer. But I just kept going back further and further and further. I went through the front door and I looked at the medical literature, which had been there just sleepy. You know, no one had been paying attention to it. This is going back 50 years. And then I thought, I'm going to go a little further back with this. And then I found the whole 1800s, iodine was the most prescribed medicine.
Wow.
And it just sort of snowballed. And then we found that more and more people started taking iodine, and their results were phenomenal. But we couldn't have anticipated how deficient in iodine people were, and how it became very extreme at a certain point when they took iodine out of baked goods and they put bromide in baked goods, which caused an iodine deficiency. So, and also bromide fire retardants were at the same time in the 70s started. So this is when we saw breast cancer rates go from like 1 in 23 to 1 in 7 or 8, depending on where you live. And so there's a whole parallel that you can see. As iodine leaves the body, people are much more prone to breast cancer, thyroid cancer, ovarian cancer, those kinds of things.
Right. And this started in the 1970s.
Yes.
And it's amazing. You could eat a slice of bread then and get your recommended daily dose of iodine.
Yes.
And then there were two doctors that wrote a paper and said that iodine was terrible. And so the doctors learned to not use it. They thought it was poison. And then all of a sudden you had a whole new direction. And doctors now, really, most doctors, unless they are well educated with this particular wonderful, wonderful product or ingredient, medicine, they are just going to think it's poison.
Yes, it's funny. Not funny, but it's almost ironic how public policy can change so quickly.
Yes.
And on the basis of nothing.
Exactly, what you talk about. All righty, we are going for a 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Deanna, our guest this first hour is Lynn Farrow. She is the author of this wonderful, wonderful book titled The Iodine Crisis: What You Don't Know About Iodine Can Wreck Your Life. Her websites are lynnfarrow.net and breastcancerchoices.org. She is also the editor of iodineresearch.com. I loved what you said at the beginning of chapter 3. You were at a conference, and you said that you had attended a lot of conferences over the years because you are a researcher, and you were talking, and there was a surgeon who was giving a talk, and he was the director of breast cancer services at one of the country's major cancer hospitals. And you asked this question, and you said, does radiation therapy increase overall survival in breast cancer patients? And you said that you asked this question because you had researched the medical literature and already knew the answer, which was no. You were simply testing him to see if his information was reliable. And he said, and I quote, radiation must increase survival because we do it at our hospital, unquote. I just, oh, that was, I wish I could have been in the room.
I wish you had been in the room, because I was at such a loss for words. I couldn't believe he actually said that out loud. It's something he might have thought. But that's the kind of groupthink and arrogance that these hospitals, these major cancer hospitals, have. They think somebody before them has checked the statistics. And they rely on that. Or they'll say, well, my mentor says it's okay, so that's what we should do. Or it's in the guideline book, so it must be proven to extend survival. And, of course, it's not proven to extend overall survival, but they recommend it anyway.
Amazing.
So it's absolutely jarring to see that the people who at the highest levels have not read the basic literature. And at Breast Cancer Choices, what makes our site different is that we only look at the conventional published literature on these procedures. We don't make up anything. So what that means is, if we can find proof that radiation doesn't have any survival benefit for breast cancer, overall survival, because it's so hard on the heart and lungs, if we can find that in the conventional literature, why aren't they reading their own literature?
Indeed, and this is where you actually began, was in their literature.
Yes.
And something else you said in the same chapter, oncologists and surgeons were too busy following the committee-generated guidelines to verify if they were evidence-based or not. All you need to do is look it up, and you will see that in breast cancer, what they refer to as evidence-based medicine is not evidence-based. It is consensus-based.
Consensus-based. And if you go for a second opinion, you're going to get the same opinion mostly, because the guidelines are just consensus. And if you actually go online and find these guidelines, they're filled with disclaimers that say this is only consensus. And then they go, yeah, then you go three pages in and you have to click on another link that says, this is a disclaimer that I realize this is only the consensus, that it's not evidence-based. So they're, by their own declaration, going by the current thinking, not the current evidence. Well, this isn't any Sherlock Holmes thing here. Our website, and I started with my experience, and then people helped and chimed in and helped me research this. But this isn't any super sleuthing. This is just when someone says something, looking it up and looking up what the statistics mean. So it is there to be found if you have breast cancer.
Now, a Massachusetts woman is under arrest, under psychiatric evaluation.
You also said something else that I thought was very significant, that most people, out of fear, when they've been diagnosed, they will immediately turn over their body to the first authority, a doctor authority, and because they are afraid, they will go along with what the doctor wants to do, which is the standard of care according to those guidelines, and they just don't think anything about it, and they actually become a little bit incensed, and for instance, in a forum you were referring to, that it's difficult to criticize an authority figure that somebody, a patient, has invested in, because they put so much trust in that authority figure to fix them that it's difficult to counter anything that the authority might say.
Yes, I face that in neighbors and people I run into online, who they'll say, and they'll be doing the opposite of what they should be doing sometimes, I mean, clearly. And I'll say something like, but the evidence is, and I'll cite the evidence, and they'll say, well, I have to go with my doctor, right or wrong. And it's taken me a while to try to understand that framework, that people are so scared they'll follow anybody with a clipboard rather than look at the facts. They sort of want to identify with a doctor, a family friend that's a doctor or something like that, and they think this is something that I say over and over again, that it gets you in trouble when you start saying to yourself, they must know what they're doing, mm-hmm. because they're at this famous hospital, or because they've got a PhD and an MD, and they are on a team. No, that doesn't mean they know what they're doing. Check, you know, all you need to do is check. Just fact check this stuff. But people are afraid to fact check. They want to bond and invest with an authority. And that goes against, especially since I had been burned by this, and I learned that math is your friend, after, you know, years of thinking I couldn't do math, I could really understand the difference between reduces recurrence and overall survival. I mean, that wasn't rocket science to figure out. But the practice is really based on this consensus, and if the doctors don't follow standard of care, they get in trouble. So it's really a case where you have to look for yourself. You cannot just invest in the nearest authority figure, no matter how many initials they have on their name or how prestigious the institution is.
Sure. And I think survival rate is 3-4%, which is, as you mentioned, if you just do the math and figure, that doesn't sound really very promising.
No. And the thing is, your listeners would understand this, as often they get statistics like 3% with chemotherapy regimens and so forth, but there's never been a double-blind study so on chemotherapy. There may be on like some very harmless kind of breast cancer or something like that, in which they wouldn't even give chemotherapy, but there's never been a double-blind study that you would require for an asthma medicine or something like that. So we don't know if the chemotherapy is doing better or worse, because the placebo rate can be, you know, up to 75%. So there's really not enough evidence around for this. And people will often say about non-conventional therapies, well, there's no literature and there's none of this. Well, there's no literature in the chemotherapy world for double-blind studies. So we really don't have any statistics that could maybe be making it worse for all we know, until someone gives two groups, you know,
sure.
a control group and a treatment group. Until we find that information out, we just don't know. You're just flying blind.
Sure. All righty. I'm sorry to interrupt. We are going to a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest this first hour is Lynn Farrell, the author of The Iodine Crisis, What You Don't Know About Iodine Can Wreck Your Life. It is available at Amazon, even as a Kindle. Her websites are lynnfarrow.net and breastcancerchoices.org. She is the editor of the website iodineresearch.com. I just feel like buying a dozen of your books and just passing them out to my friends and family. It's just that. It is that important. One of the things I really like about your book is in part two, is your frequently asked questions. And the second question on that list is nutritional iodine the same as the iodine in the medicine cabinet, which I think it should top the list of questions.
Yes, that's a good question, because people often think that the iodine they know is sort of the old-fashioned iodine with the skull and crossbones. Now, that's iodine. The reason it has the skull and crossbones is not because of the iodine. It's because it's in a kind of alcohol that could be toxic to you. So let's, you know, rule that out immediately. But the kind of iodine we talk about when people have iodine as a supplement is something that was invented in the early 1800s called Lugol's solution, which is simply potassium iodide and potassium iodine. Now, these days, you can still get Lugol's solution on the Internet or eBay or Amazon is probably your best bet. But you can also get it in tablet form, in the form of Iodorol or Iodorex. So it's very convenient to take that way. That's the way most of us take our iodine.
Indeed. What health problems does iodine deficiency cause? And this could go on. It could be a very long list. But
well, actually, I find out more problems every day that it causes, because sometimes the problems are secondary. We like to think that since the lion's share of iodine is usually taken up by the thyroid, any kind of thyroid condition is caused by an iodine deficiency, from the most part that we can ascertain because of the results we get when people that are hyperthyroid or hypothyroid take iodine. This is like an age-old memory. An age-old treatment and remedy. But also things that you wouldn't think of. There's a lot of iodine in the brain, in the breast, in the ovaries, in the testicles, in the skin, in the salivary glands, in the stomach. I know one of the people that was taking iodine for his thyroid had a reflux problem for years and years and been taking Tums and all sorts of things to keep the acid reflux down. And while he was taking the iodine for his thyroid, the inside of his esophagus that he had to have like reamed out because of the scar tissue from the acid in the stomach, which he was told was a permanent condition, that went away. So something of 30 years duration that he would have to go for an inpatient procedure in the hospital to have cleared up. Suddenly, you know, after, you know, several months, he realized he wasn't taking any of his antacid or reflux medication. So that's a really important one. And also, for over 100 years, iodine has been used for heart arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation in particular, has been benefited by iodine. But things like dry skin, which may be secondary to or as a result of hypothyroid, menstrual irregularities, polycystic ovarian syndrome, it lowers your cholesterol. The people that have had genital herpes flare-ups, several times a year, find that if they take enough, that is, like, say, 50 milligrams, they don't get the flare-ups. So all these reports come in. Fibromyalgia is a really important one. Some of the fibromyalgia organizations really try to put everybody on the iodine protocol. And in our Facebook group called the Iodine Workshop, there's a woman there who was in so much pain and weakness from her fibromyalgia that her husband had to cut her meat for her.
Yes.
And she was a health provider herself, and so she tried iodine. And after a few weeks, she had terrible brain fog as well. It began to resolve, but she, being responsible, she didn't want to say anything until she was on iodine for 12 weeks, and then she just sort of came out, and as is riding bicycles and is just traveling, doing things that she hasn't been able to do for years. So it's really life-changing, and one of the advantages of writing a book that I had not counted on at all is that people who are helped by the information email you, and with wonderful stories, and it's so rewarding. Even from Korea, because the book is available on Kindle, it's distributed all over the world. So some English speaking person in Korea will get it, find it transforms their life, and then because of my email is available, it's very easy to find, I hear these wonderful stories. So even when the book was going to public, into print, I more and more stories kept coming, and I included many in the book.
Fabulous.
But then after the book was published, it just sort of exploded with people telling me more and more. But even like in little insignificant things like scars resolving or their dry eyes no longer were a problem and they didn't have to take expensive pharmaceutical drugs.
Isn't that just amazing? This is just terrific. Now, we used to believe that we would get enough iodine in iodized salt. And that's no longer true, if it ever was true.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. Well, the salt was iodized in 1924, and it was basically the amount that they put in was just enough to try to prevent goiter. And also at that time there wasn't bromide around, so they didn't need that much iodine. But the iodine in salt, well, first of all, it evaporates most of it, or sublimes. That's the technical word. So by the time if you open it for 2 weeks or 4 weeks, it's pretty much gone out of your canister. So that's really just not enough iodine. And you can't take seaweed anymore because it's so contaminated with pollutants and arsenic and so forth. So the only way you can really get iodine is not from salt, but supplementing it, unfortunately. As natural as you want to be, we live in an environment that's been poisoned, and iodine is a kind of antidote to some of these poisons, like bromide in particular, or the anti-iodine. So we really have no choice other than to supplement.
Sure. Now, is the supplementation safe?
Yes, it is safe if you go slow, and if it's great if you have an iodine-literate doctor who can guide you through that, because you have iodine in every cell of your body. And occasionally I ran into a librarian who said, I love your book, but I'm allergic to iodine. And she would be dead if she was allergic to iodine. What she was allergic to was the cat stick, the dye that's in CAT scans, that particular iodine, which is, it's not the iodine per se, it's the dye, and the whole molecule is different. Or if you say, oh, I can't eat iodine, I'm allergic to shellfish, well, that's not the iodine in the shellfish, it's a specific protein. I mean, you can look all this up. I didn't decide this. I mean, the scientists have broken down the allergens in shellfish and in the radioactive dye. So you cannot be allergic to iodine. There is a condition that it's extremely rare. If someone has an autonomous nodule on their thyroid that's making thyroid hormone, then iodine may make it make more of the hormone some of the time. But I think in Dr. Brownstein's practice, where they have 3 full-time doctors prescribing iodine, I think they've seen it like twice in all the years that they've been practicing. And we've come across some in the iodine movement, some people that have had the nodules taking the iodine anyway because it made them feel better. And they haven't had that response. But still, that's a condition that you would, the autonomous nodule condition is something you would just approach iodine more carefully than anybody else would.
Sure. Now, people have benefited from iodine in so many ways, and you give several examples. And one of the things that you have to think when you were talking, I thought, well, if people were really allergic to iodine, if it wasn't safe, and they had to call their doctor to find out if they should take iodine, everybody in the 1970s who were eating pieces of bread would have had an issue, right?
Never thought of it that way. That's true.
Indeed. All righty. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest this first hour is Lynn Farrow. She is the author of The Iodine Crisis, What You Don't Know About Iodine Can Wreck Your Life. Her websites are lynnfarrow.net and breastcancerchoices.org. She is the editor of iodineresearch.com. Now, how can a person tell if they are iodine deficient? And you also mentioned an iodine literate practitioner, which I just read Dr. Brownstein's book, and I thought, well, I'm going to take it. I didn't go and check it out.
Well, I think it, from all the tests that have been done, more than 90% of the people are iodine deficient. So you can pretty much assume that you are, and or you can start taking it and a year down the road take the iodine loading test and see, you know, what your iodine levels are in that. But because of if the studies that were done by the government showed that iodine excreted in the urine, that's how we measure the public, I mean, decreased by 50% since the 70s, since iodine was taken out of bread and fire retardants with bromide were introduced. So you can pretty much assume that it's very likely that you're iodine deficient, and just try it and see if you feel any differently. You know, we always say start low, go slow. And there's companion nutrients that I mentioned in the book that you could optimally, that's a good thing to take, especially selenium. That would be the best way to take it. But people have just taken it willy-nilly and gotten good results. I know there's a person who was sent home because she had metastatic uterine cancer, and her female mail carrier had read my book for fibrocystic breast disease. She had been taking iodine for fibrocystic breast disease, and so the woman is in hospice, and she thought, you have nothing to lose. Why don't you just take 50 milligrams of iodine and see what happens? And she did, and she had been using a catheter because of the invasiveness of the cancer, and then she found she wasn't needing the catheter, went to the doctor, and the doctor could only find just a little bit of the metastasis left in the area. So, you know, it's sort of like it's so cheap, and it's such a benign thing to take, and especially if you go slowly. There's really very little downside to taking it, and the upside reports that come in, you know, every single day are just the stakes are too high not to take iodine, especially when we know we can document that there's such an iodine deficiency by just looking at the government statistics of the 50% less iodine consumed right now.
Sure. Now, you mentioned applying it topically to the breast if you have a tumor, that the tumor will just shrink and go ahead.
The studies that back up cysts, reducing cysts very rapidly with the topical application, that even works with when you take it internally, it will help. But if you do both the internal iodorol, say 50 milligrams of that, and then topically applying the iodine to the breast, that should just zap those cysts very, very efficiently. There's very few people for whom it doesn't work quickly. There's some really people that have struggled that they're on it like a year and a half and they get rid of some, but there's some that are just stubborn because they're so toxic with bromide, so that has to come out.
Sure. Now, is there a possibility of taking too much iodine, will it just come out with the urine if it's too much and your body doesn't need it?
Yes, it hasn't been documented that you can take too much, but what you can get is too much detox. That's what's been observed, and Dr. Brownstein will tell you that too. If people take too much iodine, the bromide sort of gets stuck on the way out because bromide and iodine compete for the same receptors in the body. And so if you start supplementing with iodorol or iodorex, it knocks the bromide off the receptors that goes into your bloodstream, and you may get a headache, for example, or your nose might run, or you might just feel very, very tired because the bromide is sedating. So that would be an example of, in answer to your question, can you take too much? You can only take too much if you get too many detox symptoms.
Okay,
and then we have a remedy for that, which is the salt loading protocol, which has been around for 100 years. Salt and water in a certain proportion helps pull out the bromide very fast. So if you get a detox headache from taking iodine and the bromide goes to your sinuses or your frontal lobe area, you can take the salt and water and it should get rid of it within 10 minutes to a half an hour.
Right.
And that goes for other detox side effects.
Okay. A friend of mine said that there were some people who gained weight after they went on iodine.
Yes, that's another thing that we're finding some people will gain weight as part of the detox process. The iodine that's stored in your fat tissues, especially around your middle, we call that bromide tire. Because it's almost like having a spare tire sometimes. People will quickly put on a weight that has no relation to calories or any kind of intake like that. But if you stick with the iodine and pulse dose, which means stopping and starting and stopping and starting, that should make it harder for the bromide to get stuck and hold the toxins in your fat. But I've never met anybody who kept taking iodine that their weight didn't normalize.
Okay.
Or go back to at least what it was before they started iodine. And if it was due to hypothyroidism, their iodine deficiency contributed to that, they will most likely lose weight.
Okay. And so it's important. Now, I've done the salt loading, and I will do that like on the weekend or something like that. Quit taking the iodine and do the salt loading. And this is after I've been taking iodorol for several years. It's very interesting how that works. So often we've been told, oh, decrease your salt intake, when in fact it's something that we actually need. We need salt. We need good salt, not bad salt, the processed salt.
Yes. When we talk about salt loading, we talk about unrefined, unprocessed sea salt, not like the commercial salt that you get in the supermarket, which is bad for you. But unprocessed salt has a lot of different nutrients and minerals that you wouldn't otherwise get.
Incredible.
But it also has that sodium chloride thing that will pull out the bromide. So it's very beneficial.
Absolutely. Well, I have a listener whose wife has cancer, and she just started on chemotherapy. And I said, you've got to get Lynn's book. You've got to get her off chemotherapy, and you need to get her on iodine. And your book is just absolutely terrific. I wish that one of my family members would read it. It's just a wonderful book. So full of information, and the websites also are just so helpful to everyone, because as you said, 90% of the population are probably iodine deficient.
Well, thank you. I really hope that anybody who has fibrocystic breast disease, which I mentioned in the book, because I was told for years that my breasts were normal, that fibrocystic breast disease was normal. And so I was just so relieved not to have breast cancer. And then it, within the several years of being told this, that this disease I had wasn't bad, it was, I should be so lucky, I developed breast cancer. And what they're finding at the Mayo Clinic, that people who have fibrocystic breast disease, a certain percentage of them will get the breast cancer.
Amazing. Well, you're an amazing woman, and it's an amazing book, and I thank you so very much for writing it and for being on the program today.
Well, thank you. I love getting the message out.
Thanks. And we love getting it. Thank you so very, very much. All righty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour with our second guest. So stay tuned.